Brett. I was supposed to say program director, but since I am Zach, he must be Brett. The dean of the university, all people of importance here. I want to start by doing something improper, as I usually do. Organizers may not appreciate it, but I thought I should do this because this has been a very special experience for many of us. And for the interpreters, before I start reading from my paper, I want to speak to all the guests who are here from the various countries. We all arrived here some 2 days ago. And usually what happens is that when a symposium or conference comes to its bitter end, then when people are about to go and they're all in a hurry and so on, somebody stands up and says how wonderful the hosts were and how well we were treated and so on. So I thought I would improperly do it now on behalf of all of us to say we have enjoyed immensely. You have been warm, you have been wonderful, you have been efficient, and maybe all of us should give the organizers an absolute complete applause now. So just in case you don't want to applaud me, you've done it, so it's fine. Program director, most honorable organizers and participants of this conference, ladies and gentlemen, allow me first to express my sense of gratitude and humility to this, be allowed to come to this symposium for having been asked to make some contribution to it. I am particularly honored to be able to speak here today for a number of reasons. First, the issues concerned with religion, belief, and thought that you will discuss here over the next 2 days are matters of considerable significance to the attainment of peace and harmony in our universe. This is because differences in religious thinking, belief, or action have more and more the potential to cause increased strife, pain, and misery. These are consequences that humanity should make every effort to remove. Secondly, an appropriate and measured understanding of the freedom of religion, which we are all here to discuss, has the potential to give rise to a deeper appreciation of the positive dimensions of our very humanity. And finally, in an age where there is a tendency for more and more human beings to think that they are better than other human beings because they believe in a particular way, the symposium will hopefully throw some light on whether and the extent to which any sense of worldly superiority is consistent with healthy notions of both religious freedom on the one hand and of the role of religion in a plural or secular society on the other. May I impress some of the theoretical people here by saying that at the outset, in this connection, that I will not be going into the theoretical distinction between secularism and pluralism. Because in my view, it would be better to adopt the approach here that the difference in these concepts is immaterial for present purposes. Religion, conscience, thought, and belief should, I believe, be regarded as the core of our humanity, as a crucial component of our humanness. They are indeed so crucial and so essential that I doubt whether we'd be able to call ourselves human beings without them. These aspects of our personality have the potential to enable us to realize our goodness. Realize our goodness so that we become the drivers of the achievement of value wherever we may be. Yet, as I show later, the practice or manifestation of a religion or belief could give rise to difference, intolerance, lack of acceptance, or even conflict. There are many, many religions and systems of belief on this earth. And we have reached the stage of development here where every country, state, city, town, or even a village is likely to have human beings living in it who subscribe to different religions. And this is where law comes into it. Law, in its primary and most simple definition, is a set of rules adopted and enforced by society as a whole, presumably for the good of all. Law, in its most general sense, is aimed at managing conflict within society. And laws concerned with freedom of religion are, in my view, intended to cope in a way acceptable to all with those conflicts and possible negative consequences which might arise on account of differences in religion, conscience, thought, and belief. Laws that are in place concerning freedom of religion are both of an international character and even of national application only. And it is to some of these laws that I now turn. It is apparent from the detail contained in the annexion. When I refer to the annexion, I'm not going to bore you with it here. It will be published and the annexure will be there, and that's what I'm talking about. So it's apparent from the annexure to this paper that international law provisions concerning freedom of religion are virtually universal. They are, as you will see from the annexure, contained in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the United Nations International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, in the Americas, the American Declaration of the Rights of Man, and also the American Convention on Human Rights. In Europe, of course, the European Convention on Human Rights, and in Africa, the African Charter on Human and People Rights, the Banjul Charter, and the African Charter on the Rights of the Welfare of the Child. This is in itself an indication of the importance of freedom of religion clauses. As will be seen from the annexure, provision for freedom of religion is also made in national constitutions of many countries, and there are many instruments which contain them, including instruments in the United States of America, South Africa, Canada, India, Germany, and many other countries. It is as well to start by recognizing what these instruments do not say. Firstly, they are not limited to freedom of religion, but apply to freedom of conscience, thought, and belief as well. The next important aspect to note is that none of the constitutional provisions provide that a belief in God is an essential prerequisite to the protection that is afforded. It must follow, therefore, that the protection is given whether the person concerned believes in God or not. The third significant conclusion that can be legitimately drawn from all these provisions taken together is that none of them creates a hierarchy in relation to the importance of the beneficiary of the protection. In other words, it is not material for purposes of these instruments whether thought, belief, conscience, or religion is the subject matter of the protection. All these elements are protected equally. Finally, and most importantly, the instruments that are highlighted are not of a religious character. They cannot and do not say anything at all about what should happen inside a religion or what a religious belief should or should not embrace. These provisions are what we may call legal provisions as distinct from religious provisions. They are about religion and the way in which religion would work in a multi-religious, multicultural environment. It must be accepted, therefore, that these freedom of religion provisions are not intended to be, nor can they be in every detail, consistent with every religion. They are concerned not with intra-religious issues, but what may be called inter-religious issues and inter-belief matters for the benefit of all the people within the jurisdiction of the instrument concerned. It is now time to talk about some of the dimensions that most of the international instruments have in common. The two of them, or three. The first is that all of them guarantee the right to freedom of religion and conscience and the right to practice a religion. Parents and guardians, secondly, of children, have the right or duty, depending on the instrument you look at, to ensure that children are brought up in accordance with their convictions or that they receive guidance or direction. Children receive guidance or direction in accordance with what they believe. The second dynamic is that these rights are hardly ever unlimited. In other words, in all these instruments, the right to freedom of religion is limited in one way or another. The limitations in each of these instruments are expressed differently depending on the instrument you look at, but no instrument that I have come across talks to the practice of religion without qualification and regardless. So, for example, the United Nations instrument, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, limits, quote, the freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs, unquote, by saying that this manifestation of practice is subject only to, quote, limitations as are prescribed by law and are necessary to protect public order, health or morals, or the fundamental rights and freedoms of others. The European and the American conventions are generally to the same effect, except that they do not expressly refer to the limitation being necessary for the enjoyment of fundamental rights and freedoms. The provision in the African Charter likewise limits. Although negatively phrased, their limitation clause provides for a limitation of rights. According to this provision, measures restricting the exercise of these freedoms, that's the right to religious freedoms, may be taken subject only to, quote, law and order. The third aspect that is common to all, is that no particular religion is singled out over and above other religions. It must follow from this that all religions practiced within the jurisdiction of the international instrument concerned are regarded by the instruments themselves as worthy of equal respect and protection. It should not matter for the purpose of the application of the instrument whether the religion is one which has been practiced for a long time or whether it is new. Shouldn't matter whether it is a religion which is practiced by a vast majority of people in a particular country or a minority. Should not matter again whether it falls in the category of being a traditional religion or not. It is true that the practice of one aspect of a particular religion may be limited where practice in that respect does not exist in other religions where the manifestation concerned is regarded as necessary to be protected. That apart, all religions must be treated equally. So the first challenge that arises in the case of international instruments is that the limitation of the right to practice religion must be necessary within the meaning of the instrument concerned. And the difficulty is that courts decide whether it is necessary or not. And in the determination of whether a limitation is necessary, whether there is a law that does so, important balancing processes are required. The next related challenge arises from the fact that all these instruments do not confine themselves to the protection of the right to freedom of religion alone. They go further. They also protect the right to equality, for example, the right to equal protection of the law, the right to non-discrimination on grounds like sex, race, and gender, and so on. The third challenge is that while each religion or system of belief encourages and even mandates a value system of its own, the international instruments themselves might provide or imply, with all the rights in them read together, a value system. And the problem then arises, which value system has dominance? value system of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, or on the other hand, the value system which inevitably arises from every religion. The next challenge is less important in the international arena than in the case of national instruments. This is because each state which is a signatory to an international instrument enjoys what is referred to as a margin of appreciation. These international instruments give states a measure of liberty, if you like. If the challenge in the context of the installment of the enforcement of international freedom of religion clauses could be expressed broadly, it would be put like this. How far can international instruments go to limit the right of freedom of religion as encapsulated in international instruments? And the same problem, I may say, arises perhaps more deeply in national instruments. A reference to the general approach of the European Court of Human Rights, as reiterated in a recent case, and the publication will have the name of the case, it was actually a case in Turkey, will, I think, be useful. The court made it plain that freedom of thought, conscience, and religion is one of the foundations of a democratic society. It went on to say, quote, "This freedom is in its religious dimension one of the most vital elements that go to make up the identity of believers and their conception of life," unquote. But the court also emphasized that the right is not important to religious believers alone. The court said in no uncertain terms that the right is also a, quote, "precious asset for atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and the unconcerned." It was also said that the freedom is one, quote, "to hold or not to hold religious beliefs and to practice or not to practice a religion." The state had a duty, so the European Court held, to ensure that everyone's beliefs are respected. In addition, the state's role is one of a, quote, "neutral and impartial organizer of various religions, faiths, and beliefs." This neutrality is, quote, "incompatible," unquote, with any state power to, quote, "assess the legitimacy of religious beliefs or the ways in which those beliefs are expressed." This is very important. The state does not have the power to assess the legitimacy of religious beliefs or the ways in which those beliefs are expressed. Religious tolerance was also important. Finally, the European Court reiterated that the spirit of compromise necessary in a democracy renders necessary, quote, "concessions on the part of individuals or groups to maintain and promote the ideals and values of a democratic society." So there's a duty on the part of the state, on the other hand, to recognize religion, but there's a duty on religious groups to maintain and promote the ideals and values of a democratic society. It was also acknowledged that other rights guaranteed by international instruments may have to be restricted in order to protect freedom of religion. So it works both ways. Before turning briefly to experiences in our country, I'd like to give a few examples of decisions of European courts of human rights in this particular area. The European Court has held, for example, that the banning of the wearing of headscarves by Muslim women students at a university in Turkey was necessary, this on the basis of the need to protect and advance the equality of women and to prevent one religion becoming more dominant than another religion. The court has also held in Switzerland that the wearing of a headscarf by a woman Muslim teacher in Switzerland was rightly prohibited, largely because of the age of the children concerned and the ease with which they might have been influenced. Thirdly, the court has held that a display of a crucifix in a classroom at a school in Spain was permissible. Finally, the final example I will use here, that a law in Armenia limiting the right of freedom of religion by prescribing compulsory military conscription was not necessary, since the subject, since it was possible for the subject to provide alternative labor. The Armenian case was particularly interesting. It was decided this year, short while ago, and the real point about the case was that up until that particular case was decided, the law was different. And the European Court had consistently gone for the previous 20 or 30 years in the direction in which it did not accord military recruitment an exception for religious purposes, and did not conclude that military recruitment should be allowed on the basis on which it did in this case. But what that demonstrates is that the law in this regard changes consistently. It will have been seen from the annexure that the provisions of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa is somewhat different from those in the international instruments. Some of these differences will now be discussed because I think it may be useful to do so. The freedom of conscience, religion, and thought and belief and opinion are provided for separately and differently in our Constitution from the right to practice a religion. Presumably, this was done on the basis that it is only practice that, generally speaking, has an impact on other members of society and on constitutional values. I would suggest that this is correct. Whatever we believe and think in our minds and hearts, provided that there is no manifestation or practice of these beliefs at all, can have no impact on society. It is for this reason that the right of these freedoms is not internally limited by the South African Constitution in any way. But the right to practice a religion is differently treated in our Constitution. People may not be denied, amongst other things, the right to practice their religion and to join and maintain linguistic associations. But the limitation of the right to practice is both express and clear. These rights in our country may not be exercised in a manner consistent, in a manner that is inconsistent with any of the rights in the Bill of Rights. The question whether any religious practice is inconsistent with our Bill of Rights has not yet properly come before our courts. It has not yet been determined, therefore, what the phrase inconsistent with the Bill of Rights means. Nevertheless, there's a strong argument that the rights in the Bill of Rights might assume a somewhat greater status in our country than the right to practice one's religion. Two cases that came before the Constitutional Court in connection with freedom of religion may actually be mentioned at this stage, and I'll discuss them briefly. Mr. Prince, and you'll find that the publication has all the references to these cases, but Mr. Prince, a Rastafarian, wished to be exempted from a provision of South African legislation that prohibited possession or dealing in cannabis, or dacha as it is called in our country. Mr. Prince did not say that the law that prohibited the possession and dealing in, and by necessary implication the consumption of, dacha was bad as a whole and should be set aside as a whole. In other words, he did not want the result that everyone in South Africa should be allowed to use dacha. He went a slightly different route. Apparently content with the general prohibition, he asked the court to carve out an exception for all Rastafarians alone on the basis that the use and consumption of dacha was essential to the practice of his religion. That was the first case. In the second case, the Christian Education Society, which ran 300 schools consistently with its constituency's understanding of the Christian faith also said that the rights of its members to religious freedom had been infringed by a provision, a legislative provision, exacted by a South African law. That prohibition was, according to the legislature, aimed at giving effect to the values of our constitution. The law, which they challenged, prohibited corporal punishment from being administered by teachers to children at schools. They referred to corporal punishment, that is the Christian Education Foundation, referred to corporal punishment as corporal correction, and insisted that their religious convictions derived from the Bible, as they understood it, made it obligatory on parents to authorize the children to engage in corporal correction whenever this was considered to be necessary. So in other words, they said that their interpretation of the Bible meant that they had to be allowed to authorize their children, their teachers, to give the children a hiding at school. The Christian Education Society, like Mr. Prince, did not challenge the constitutionality of the prohibition as it applied to everyone else. The society strenuously contended for an exception to be carved out for itself, its schools, and its members. The Constitutional Court accepted in both cases that it could not second guess the genuineness or the veracity of the belief. And you remember that this echoes from courts otherwise as well. It's not for us to assess whether a religious belief is good or not good. We operate in a secular terrain. That genuineness, that is the genuineness of the belief, could not, according to the court, be tested by cross-examination or in any other way. The Constitutional Court accordingly accepted that the religious beliefs were real and genuine. The next question to be answered, therefore, was whether the limitation of the right to freedom of religion, which had occurred in each of the two cases of that we had, could be justified. And you will see that our Constitution, too, has a limitation. And that limitation says that the limitation must be made by a law of general application, which is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on dignity, equality, and freedom. The court said that because there was no challenge to the provisions as they applied to everyone, remember I told you that all they were seeking out was an exception for themselves, the court had to accept that the limitation of the right of everyone else was good and justified. The question to be answered in that case, therefore, was whether the granting of the exemption would undermine the law as it applied to everyone else. The Constitutional Court held in both cases that the law would be undermined and relief was refused. In fact, the Constitutional Court held that if the law were not undermined, exemptions could be granted, otherwise not. I must finally discuss a case which, according to many religious organizations, had religious freedom implications. Our Constitution provides that no one may be discriminated against on the ground of their sexual orientation. And the case that had to be decided was about a law that did not allow gay and lesbian people to be married. And we had to determine whether that law was inconsistent with the equality provision in our Constitution. The Constitutional Court came to the conclusion that it was inconsistent with the Constitution. The objection before and after the case by many religious organizations was centered around the freedom of religion right. Yet, in my view, the judgment had no religious implication whatsoever. No church or other religious institution would ever be obliged to conduct the marriage ceremony, and no person who said that his freedom of religion would be impacted upon if he or she were to contract a gay or lesbian marriage would be forced to do so. Officers employed by the state would conduct a civil marriage ceremony if the people concerned wanted to be married. On the divide between freedom of religion on the one hand and the need not to oppress minority practices that are not palatable to majorities, on the other hand, I would suggest that this case was rightly decided. This brings me to the question of religious oppression. There is religious oppression in many parts of the world, and that oppression is aimed at advancing a particular hegemonic position at the expense of the religious practice concerned. The aim is not to protect other rights, but either to oppress other religions for its own sake, or to oppress and suppress for the sheer purpose of advancing one's own religion, one's own cause, or one's own agenda. This is on any basis unacceptable, particularly if this is done by a state that proclaims its adherence to pluralism or to secularism. And I would make one more point in this regard. Majority religions, or the religions of the more powerful, protect themselves. The protection of the protection of religious practice, as well as the practice and belief, together with the protection of the right to equality, can therefore, in my view, legitimately be said to have greater application in the protection of religious or beliefs or practices of minorities. Religions, religious practices, or beliefs of minorities, vulnerable people, or on the basis of the non-discrimination of people who themselves are vulnerable. So it's not really about majority protection. It is about the protection of those who are vulnerable. The protection of people who represent minorities or who are vulnerable is fundamental to a democratic constitutional order. It is an important change of perspective, this, from the dubious concept of the law of the jungle, or to put it another way, the inhumane notion that might is right. And we care for vulnerable people and protect them, not for their sakes, but for ours, because it is our values which require minorities and vulnerable people to be protected. May I conclude perhaps by saying something somewhat controversial? This is that the idea of religious tolerance is not sufficiently dynamic to cater for the needs of a modern pluralist society. This is particularly so if religious tolerance allows for the correctness of a feeling in one human being that her religion or belief is in some way superior, however slightly, to the beliefs and practices of others. I find this notion unacceptable, and the approach destructive to the humanity of us all. We're all human beings. I strongly believe that we should not harbor any notion that we as human beings are better than other human beings. We're entitled to our own beliefs. I look forward to the world where every human being will internalize the proposition that our common humanity is paramount, and that every human being has the potential to add value, irrespective of the religion to which that human being belongs. I thank you.
For a very interesting and stimulating address that sets the stage for our discussion over the next 2.5 days. Justice Yacoub has agreed to receive questions, and we have about 15 minutes for that before we will repair downstairs for a reception and some hors d'oeuvres. So I will recognize those who would like to ask a question. The primary consideration is you must speak into a microphone. We have interpreters interpreting into 10 different languages, And if we don't speak into a microphone, which I'm apparently not doing, if we don't speak into a microphone, the interpreters who are in a different room will be rendered mute. So we will pass around a microphone. We have some students with microphones. And let me recognize our first question here. Let's keep our questions brief, and let's keep our questions one each.
Brasileira de Liberdade Religiosa e Cidadania. Sou cristão e vou fazer uma pergunta sobre a separação da igreja com o Estado. O Estado tem o dever de proteger o fato religioso.
I'm getting no English here, so I can't hear your question. I'm sorry.
Let me turn. Sorry, this hasn't been turned on yet. On one.
Hello. Can you hear me? Is it okay? We're ready. My name is Samuel. I am from Brazil. I'm Christian. And I preside the Brazilian Association of Brazilian Freedom for Religion. The state has the duty to defend the religious fact, but when it comes to separation of the state and the church, you cannot promote religious facts. What happens is many countries where we have that principle, many situations will come to cause a lot of confusion. In tradition of this, the constitution, the Brazilian constitution, the constituents registered that we protect under God, this constitution is protected by God. But that does not happen in any other law, but it's in a tradition of our constitution, but doesn't show in any other law. But there are countries that look into the divinity of their coins and public places like the court, the legislation buildings, or even in buildings for the executive power. And under those considerations, I ask, in a particular case of Brazil, do you think the absence of the protection of God would make God less present in the process to elaborate the constitution? The presence of religious symbol, is that something needed by the human beings or by God? In the other hand of the separation between church and state, how can we leave our religious mark in all that we do? That's the question I bring here to be considered. Thank you very much.
I'm sure that you will discuss this question on many an occasion during this conference. But I want to say that the issue of God is a very difficult one, because our constitution, although it is a secular one, says in its introduction, God bless our country. And none of us regard this as problematic. All of us begin to know that God can be a symbol of many kinds. And God can be understood in many, many ways. That being said, there may be a problem if the symbol of God is overdone. So if it is too much done, it may be a difficulty. And I think that the logic of the situation is that atheists like me are very few and far between, that the majority of people believe in God, and unless it is truly overdone, I would find it very difficult actually to say that the use of the symbol of God in any particular country would necessarily be problematic. Because God is also, in some senses, said to be understanding and merciful and generous.
Other questions? Yes, please. Just a second. Can you help make sure that microphone is on? Do we have the other microphone nearby? Let's try the other microphone.
Thank you. It's actually this one. Yeah.
Can the translators hear? Can the translators hear?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Okay, I think we're okay now.
Yes, Isakulu is my name. I'm from Nigeria. I want the lecturer to throw some light on infringement on religious freedom, particularly when such infringements appear to be discriminatory. For example, I do not see the difference between a Muslim wearing a scarf and the covering of the head by a Catholic nun in France, for instance. But while it is condemned in one case or prohibited in one case, it is allowed in the other. Is there any justification within the law for this, particularly in the so-called democratic societies?
Yeah, I think at first blush it can be a problem. I cited those cases simply to make plain that the analyses are never straightforward. And the point really to make is that there are differences between the different constitutions. So, for example, in the Turkey case, the Turkish constitution, unlike any other constitution, made it quite clear that it, Turkey, was a constitutional state, and that was in the context of Muslims having been perceived in Turkey to have had an over-exercise of their position. And that was the contextual thing which that court rightly or wrongly took into account. In the case of the teacher wearing a scarf, the position, the problem there was a different one, because they said the children were very small. And in relation to the crucifix, the problem was that the court thought that nobody took, that the crucifix had become so much a part of life in Spain that nobody took due notice of it. In fact, our constitutional court too had a case of that kind, which I should have mentioned. And that there were funny cases where there was a law which said that liquor could not be sold, and this law would not affect Mormons at all, so it won't be a freedom of religion case for them. But it said that liquor could not be sold at all on Sundays, Good Friday, and Christmas Day. Those were the three holidays chosen. And the argument advanced, and I wasn't at the court then, the argument advanced was that this impacted on freedom of religion. I would have, if I were there, I would have asked the question, which freedom and whose freedom of religion? Because all they were interested in was selling liquor and making money. Religion had very little to do with all of this, but nonetheless, the majority of the court held, and that's the importance of the decision, that all holidays like Christmas and Sundays and so on had begun to achieve a secular character because they were seen by everybody as holidays, and therefore they'd lost their religious, their necessary religious thing. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I just wanted to point out that these cases are quite complicated. They actually depend on the facts of each particular case.
It's worth noting that the French prohibition on head coverings is worded neutrally, so it applies to Muslim headscarves, Jewish prayer caps, and to nuns' habits as well. Whether it is targeted or not is another question, but the wording of the law, at least, is designed to be neutral. Do we have other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Yacoub. I have
a little loudly.
Yeah. My name is Valon, and I'm coming from Kosovo. I wanted to ask you one question. Is there any relationship between the limited government or large government to the freedom of religion?
Large government or small government?
I think that there is a difference. There is a difference because large governments would ordinarily consist of people who belong to more than one religious grouping, and small governments need not. Smaller countries are more likely to have a large number of people practicing one religion and not too many religions. So in a very odd way, in the larger countries, there's so much diversity that freedom of religion is more easily managed, in my view. But if you get to a small country, then the people who practice minority religions become even fewer. And in a almost contradictory kind of way, minorities suffer more historically from the oppression of their religions in smaller countries than in larger countries, precisely because the countries are small, and precisely because small cannot accommodate diversity, large can.
Final question.
There are those who argue that offending religious feelings as a result, say, of a ruling such as the ruling recently made by the South Africa Constitutional Court on same-sex marriages also offends the non-establishment clause, where the offense is based on religious grounds. How do you react to this?
Yeah, but I tried to give you that response in my paper. I think it's all about a country's attitude to minorities. And the difficulty is that once you start saying, as a country, that in the interest of religious minorities, you are now going to start curbing the rights of sexual orientation minorities, in my view, that is the beginning of the slippery, slippery slide. For so long as, in my view, and this is a controversial view, as I said earlier, I stick to it though, and we can talk about it. But in my view, once you start troubling minorities on religious grounds, then you start troubling the atheists on the same ground, and so on and so on. So my real problem is you have to decide as a country whether minorities are important to us, whether we regard minorities as vulnerable, whether we accommodate difference, and the extent to which we accommodate difference. And I must say that I am much more for accommodating difference. I find the idea of any minority, whether it is a religious minority or a non-religious minority, or even a religious minority, I just find the oppression and marginalization of any group of people just utterly unacceptable. And there's a level of subjective in that, because that's part of my belief. There's no logic to it. We all believe things which don't have a logic. And I just find it repulsive, utterly repulsive. And I have to make that concession to you now.
All right. Please join me in thanking Justice Yacoub.